Chapter 14. Shima. Some say I learned dread knowledge that night, but of this, as with so many other matters, I cannot write for fear of summary execution. Drusus Acamian, The Compendium of the First Holy War. Truth and hope are like travelers in contrary directions. They meet but once in any man's life. A Nanai Proverb. Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Shima. Esmenet dreamed that she was a prince, an angel fallen from the dark, that her heart had beaten, her loins had ached for tens of thousands of years. She dreamed that Kellis stood before her, an outrage to be blotted, an enigma to be dissected, and above all, a burning question. Who are the Dunyain? When she awoke, several moments passed before she recognized herself. Reaching out through the gloom, she clutched only cool sheets where Kellis should have been. For some reason she was unsurprised, as well as uncommonly concerned. There was an oppressive sense of finality in the air, like the smell of drying ink.
Kellis?
Ever since reading the sagas, a foreboding had grown within her, an accumulation that had filled her heart and limbs with a sense of rolling heaviness. The night in the Nansur villa, the night of her possession, had stained this listless dread with a bewildering urgency. Every time she blinked, she saw things penetrated and penetrating. She could still feel the creature's hands upon her flesh, and the memory of her obedient lust seemed ever present. The hunger she had suffered that night, a thirst that only terror could touch, and that no horror could slake. At once bestial and remote, it had been a wantonness that eclipsed obscenity and became something pure. The Inkoroi had taken her, but the want, the insatiable desire, those had been hers. Of course, Kellis had tried to console her, even as he plied her with endless questions. He said much the same thing Acamian had said when explaining Zynemus's torment, that the self never stood apart when one was compelled, because it was the very thing possessed.
You can't distinguish yourself from him, Kellis explained, because for a time he was you. That's why he tried to provoke me into killing you, because he feared the memories you might have of his memories.
But the things,
she could only reply.
The things I ached for.
Grimacing faces, grinning orifices and gaping wounds, the rush of hot fluids.
Those desires weren't yours, Esme. They only seemed to be yours because you couldn't see where they came from. You simply suffered them.
But then, how does any desire belong to me?
When she learned of Zynemus's death, she told herself that he had been the cause of her distress, that her sense of encroaching doom was nothing more than concern for his well-being. But the lie was too obvious for even her to believe, and she spent hours cursing herself for her inability to mourn the man who had been such an uncompromising friend. And when, shortly after, Acamian moved with his things out of the Umbilica, she once again tried to wrap explanations around the chill morass of her heart. And even though this lie, through force of partial truth, had lasted a day and a night, it collapsed the instant she had laid wondering eyes on the actual origin of her misapprehension. Shima. This, she had thought as the great eyes of the city walls stared her down, is where we all die. Her head buzzing, she threw aside her sheets, called to the crane-embroidered screen behind which Burulan sometimes slept. Moments later she was dressed and interrogating Gaia Macri. He knew only that Kellis had left the Umbilica to wander on foot through the camp. Apparently, the dark-eyed man said with a frown, he had refused any escort. There had been a time, not so long ago, when Esmenet would have feared walking alone through the encamped holy war, but now she could imagine no place safer. The moon was bright, and save for the odd guy rope strung across her path, she found the going easy. Most fire pits either were dark or tinkled with orange coals, but an inevitable few remained awake, carousing to no purpose or drinking in sullen circles. Those who recognized her fell immediately to their knees. None had seen the warrior prophet. Then she fairly collided with a man, an Ainani knight by the look of him, and with horror she realized he had bedded her several times before her renewal. Before then, she had continually told herself that she ruled her coupling, not her custom. But the smirk on his face told her otherwise. The smirk on all their faces told her otherwise. Instantly, she understood that he took great pride in using her, the prophet consort, as his sheath. He caught her elbows and pressed her back. "Yes," he said, as though to confirm her mortification. He was very drunk. His leash, they would have said back in Sumna, had been soaked in liquor. Decorum, honor, he could easily slip these things. "Do you know who I am?" she said sharply. "Yes," he repeated, his manner lurid. "I know you." "Then you know how close you stand to death." A look of dank puzzlement, she advanced and struck him with an open palm. "Insolent dog! Kneel!" He stared, stunned, unmoving. "Kneel, or I'll have you flayed alive! Do you understand?" It took several heartbeats for his astonishment to lurch into terror, and several more for his knees to buckle. Drink always added to the momentum of such things. He fairly blubbered his apologies. And more importantly, he told her he'd seen Kellis leave the camp to climb the westward slopes. Esmanette left him, hugging her shoulders to keep from shaking. She could understand her clenched teeth, but her smile baffled her. She thought about having her agents hunt the man down on the morrow, though she had always detested the brutality that her new station had forced upon her. The thought of his screams thrilled her for some reason. Scenarios roiled through her thoughts, and though she knew they were both petty and absurd, she exulted in them nonetheless. What was it? Her shame? His smirk? Or was it the mere fact that she could do these things? "I am," she breathlessly thought, "his vessel." Lost in her worries, she climbed the shallow hillside, bemoaned the hem of her gown as she waded through thistles and moist grasses. High over the Menenor Sea, the nail of heaven flashed against the greater black. Twice she turned to stare at Shaima in the moonlight. It scarcely seemed real. She discovered Kellis sitting perched upon the ruins of one of the mausoleums that dotted the hillside, staring intently across the Sherazor at the dark city. She thought of climbing the collapsed portion, then using the wall like a catwalk, but she recalled the life she bore within her. She strode to the mossy foundations beneath him instead. He sat cross-legged, his hands upturned and clasped in his lap. He had tied his hair into a Galeoth war knot. His face looked marmoreal in the moonlight, which gleamed across the curls of his beard. As always, there was something indefinable about his pose or his manner that seemed to dwarf his immediate surroundings. Where others would seem lonely, even desolate, he seemed an unfaltering sentinel, white in the moonlight, black in its shadow. Without looking away from Shaima, he said, "You think of Karaskand. You remember the way I withdrew from you before the events leading to the circumfix. You fear that I do the same for similarly perilous reasons." Hands on her hips, she stared upward, scowled in mock disapproval. "I'm trying not to." He smiled. His eyes glittered when he looked down. "Why this?" she asked. "Why here?" "Because soon I must leave." He crouched and held down his hand. She reached up to his wrist, then suddenly found herself standing beside him, steadied by his powerful arms. For a moment, it seemed, they stood perched on the point of a needle. She glanced nervously about, at the slopes dropping toward the plain, at the blackness between the thin poplars that thronged from the interior of the ruined mausoleum. She breathed deep his smell, oranges, cinnamon, the musk of masculine sweat. Despite the fear his words had engendered, she savored him as she always did. His beard seemed white in the moonlight. She gingerly stepped back, the better to look up into his eyes. "Where are you going?" He studied her for a moment. In the distance beyond him, Shaima looked both intricate and stone ancient, a great fossil uncovered by the wash of tides. "To Kayodia,"
Esmanet scowled. Kayudia was Shaima's dead sister, destroyed long ago by some Canaan aspect emperor whose name she couldn't remember.
Your father's house, she said sourly. Truth has its seasons, Esme. Everything will be made clear in due course.
But, Kellis,
what did it mean that they had to assail Shaima without him? Proyas knows what must be done, he said decisively. The Scarlet Spires will act as they see fit.
Desperation welled through her. You can't leave us.
I must, Esme. I answer to a different voice. Not her voice, something fragile within her realized. But then neither did he answer to her customs, her concerns, or even her hopes. The things that moved her simply didn't touch him. Though they stood together, Kellis had planted his feet across a far more unfathomable ground. What moved him moved on the scale of the planets and their cycles across the night sky. Suddenly he seemed a wild stranger, like the Skilvendi, the son of something terrible.
And Akka, she asked quickly, hoping to cover this moment of weakness, shouldn't he accompany you? You must stay safe.
Where I walk, no one can follow, he said. Besides, I'm beyond his protection. He knows that now. Despite the onerous implications of what he said, he spoke with matter-of-fact ease.
He'll want to know where you've gone.
Kella smiled and nodded as though to say, that Akka, he knows. Do you think you're the only one who stalks me with well-meaning questions? For some reason, his gentle humor made her want to cry. Suddenly, she was bending her knees to the broken stone, lowering her face to the moss at his sandaled feet. How absurd she must look, she thought, kneeling atop a wall's broken lip, playing out in pantomime what others did on solid ground, a wife before her husband. But she didn't care. He was the only measure, the only judgment.
Use me.
No matter where they turned, men found themselves encircled by greater things. Usually they ignored them, and sometimes, moved by pride and base hunger, they warred against them. But either way, those things remained just as great, and men, no matter how lunatic their conceit, remained just as small. Only by kneeling, by offering themselves as one might offer the haft of a weapon, could men recognize their place in this world. Only by submitting could they recognize themselves. There was rapture in submission. The vulnerability of another towering overhead, precarious, like letting a stranger touch one's face. The sense of profound communing, as though only those who acknowledged their insignificance could themselves be acknowledged. The relief of surrender, the disburdening that accompanied the yielding of responsibility. The paradoxical sense of license. The nattering voices fell silent. The exhaustion of endless posturing melted away. She found it narcotic, even arousing, the domination of another. With a forbearing laugh, Kellis helped her to her feet. He even bent to brush the grit from her gown.
Do you know, he said, looking up, that I love you?
She smiled, and though part of her gushed like an adolescent, something older and wiser watched him with a whore's calloused eyes.
I know, she said. But you should fear what's about to happen, he said. All men should fear.
She hesitated.
I couldn't survive without you.
Hadn't she told Akka the same thing? He placed a warm and radiant hand upon the swell of her belly, and it seemed that he blessed her womb.
Nor I without you.
He enclosed her in his arms, stole her worries with a deep kiss. Though he held her with a strange fierceness afterward, she could feel his gaze drift back to Shaima. She clutched his hard frame, thinking of the strength coiled within his heart, within his limbs. She thought of the gift of prophecy and how it seemed to kill all those who dared wield it.
Never let go, she told herself. Never.
And somehow, he heard. He always heard.
Fear for the future, Esme, not me.
Fingers combed through her hair, drew tingling lines across her scalp.
This flesh is but my shadow.
How far had he walked? Kellis thought of snow-hooded mountains, the flash of sunlight across glacial heights. He thought of deep forests and lost cities, of moss-limbed statuary leaning from the humus. He thought of unmanned walls. It seemed he could hear someone shrieking his name through frozen forest arcades.
Kellas! Kellas!
How far had he come? After sending Esmanette back to the encampment, he'd traveled westward across the broken pasture, climbing the ramped hillsides. At the very summit, he paused amid several dead oaks, turned his back to the Nail of Heaven, which now lay over Shima and the Menenor, so that he could follow its axis across the dark landscape before him, toward Kayodia.
I know you can hear me,
he said to the world dark and sacred.
I know that you listen.
A sourceless wind pulled the grasses into streamers, drawing them to the southwest. Against the constellations, dead branches clacked and creaked without rhythm.
What was I to do? He replied. They attend only to what lies before their eyes. They listen only to what pleases their ears. Things unseen, things unheard, they trust to you.
The wind subsided, leaving an unearthly silence in its wake. He heard the pasty hiss of maggots squirming through the gut of a dead crow some 5 paces to his right. He heard the chatter of termites seething beneath the bark of the surrounding oaks. He tasted the sea on the air.
What was I to do? Tell them the truth?
He stooped, pulled a twig from the straps of his right sandal. He studied it by moonlight, followed the thin, muscular branchings that seized so much emptiness from the sky, tusk sprouting from tusk. Though the trees about him had died seasons previously, the twig possessed 2 leaves, one waxy green, the other brown.
No, he said. I cannot.
The Dunyane had sent him into the world as an assassin. His father had imperiled their isolation, had threatened Ishual, the great sanctuary of their hallowed meditations. They had no choice but to send Kellas, even knowing that they served Moengus's ends. What else could they do? So Kellas had walked the length of Eärwa, from the ruined wastes of the north to the raucous cities of the south. Every advantage had been exploited, be it a single smile or 1,000 fists. Every liability had been minimized. He had learned as much as the world would yield. Languages, histories, factions, the peculiarities of innumerable hearts. He had mastered her mightiest weapons, faith, war, sorcery. He was Dunyane, one of the conditioned. At every turn he followed the Logos, the shortest path. And yet he had come so far. Bound to the circumfix, slowly turning beneath Umiaki's dark bowers, Serwe gaping past him, as cold as stone against his nakedness, her face swollen and black.
I wept.
Casting aside the twig, Kellas leaned into the night and began sprinting across the grasses, toward the Betmula Mountains piling black across the horizon before him. He leapt thickets, pedaled into black ravines, then lunged up broken slopes. He ran. Not once did he stumble, nor did he slow to determine his bearings. The ground was his, conditioned. Everywhere, all about him, one world. The crossings were infinite, but they were not equal. They were not equal. To those few Kianin and Amati who heard the noise, it sounded like tapestries being beaten by slaves in the distance, but it moved above, against the stars. Along the walkways of the first temple, it became a shadow, crept along vault and ceiling fresco. For a moment, it obscured what lay beneath. Then it was gone. It drank with its eyes while its soul dreamed 1,000,000 years. Wise and cunning, animal in its fury, how this place cut with its endless edges and cramped skies. Thorns, its every glimpse speared like thorns.
The stone is weak. We could wash it away.
Do nothing, the voice replied. Just watch.
They know we are here. If we do not move, they will find us.
Then test them.
The Sifrang fell to the floor and huddled, cringed from all things exterior, all things surface. It waited, longed for the pitching deeps. Soon one of them came. The manling had no eyes, and yet saw as it did, though without the pain. But the salt of his fear tasted no different. It rose and revealed its form. Zayas, his face as bright as the sun. The manling made noise in terror, then unleashed his own light, a thread of raw energy. With one hand, Zayas grasped the thread, curious. When he pulled, the soul was yanked from the manling. The light vanished. The meat slapped the floor.
Weak.
There are others, the voice said. Far, far stronger.
Perhaps I will die.
You are too mighty.
Perhaps you will die with me, Iacus.
Something, a pendulous absence, circled above Achaemenion. He should be awake. But the smell had pummeled Seswatha to his knees, forced him to retch again and again. Burning spittle was the most he could manage, but still his innards heaved and heaved. Standing in the gloom above, now Coyote watched him, too weary for expression. Through endless dark they had climbed, higher and higher, knowing that sooner or later the emptiness had to yield to horrors. It began with raining waste, urine, excrement, trailing from seams, spilling in skirts they had to leap through. They passed wells that had once been corridors, where streams of slurry toppled down into endless dark. They circled great pits of rotting flesh, where corpses, some fetal and malformed, others full-grown, had been thrown from unknown heights. And once they had even crossed a lake filled with brackish water, what must have been the accumulation of thousands of years of rain. They had wept for relief while bathing. It was no mean thing to be cleansed in such a place. Of course, Seswatha had heard rumors. Once he'd even had occasion to speak at length with Nilgikas, who had battled through the halls of this place thousands of years before. But nothing could prepare Seswatha for the horrid immensity of the Inkuhaloinus. According to the Non-Man King, not one in 100 in Koroi survived the Ark's fall from the heavens, and yet 1,000,000 of them had warred against the Non-Men over the course of their innumerable wars. The Ark, Nilgikas insisted, was an ingrown world, a labyrinth of labyrinths.
Be wary, the white lips had intoned. No matter how deep, the cup of evil always overflows.
Now Coyote had seen the light first, a pale glimmer hanging at the terminus of a side passage. Dousing their own light, they crept along the incline. Silence came easily. The planks that righted the skewed floors had long since given way to a kind of earth, the accretion, Seswatha decided, of detritus shed and packed over the ages. With every step, the reek became more pungent. The roaring clamor swelled only as they crossed the last few paces. The passage simply ended. What had been a single light was broken into thousands and pitched across yawning space. Now Coyote had gasped and cursed, while Seswatha, after gaping for several breathless moments, had fallen to his knees and vomited. What he smelled was human, and it seemed the most unbearable stench of all. A city. They found themselves staring across a city. The steaming heart of Golgotharoth. He should be awake. A cavernous void opened before them. It reminded Seswatha of a ship's ribbed hold, though pitched on its end, and far too vast to truly resemble any work of men. Sheer golden faces reared into obscurity, hazed by the smoke of countless fires. Structures of mortise and hacked stone climbed their foundations, crusting their sides like stacked hornets' nests, not dwellings, but open cells, squalid and innumerable. It all would have looked like something revealed by low tide were it not for the fires and the figures teeming like mites across it. Lumbering files of bashrag, gibbering masses of srank, and among them, human captives, untold numbers of them,
Some shackled to sledges in great groaning trains, others scattered across the open-air harems of their captors, gagging beneath convulsing shadows, their mouths working, their eyes rolled up to the dark, pink and naked and bloodied, countless men, women, and children. The bodies of the broken choked the alleys below. He should be awake. The pealing roar, screams upon screams, wailing across heights of alien gold, reverberating through bones and heart. Reverberating, reverberating. Now Coyote slumped to his knees.
What is this?
More of a breath than a whisper. He turned to his teacher, his pupils ringed by crazed white.
This?
Spoken like a bereaved child. Awake! Saswatha felt himself hoisted and thrown back into shadow. Something cracked his skull, and murk encompassed everything until he could see only his beloved student's anguish, his lunatic hurt.
Where is she? Where?
Awake, you fool!
With a gasp, Akamian clawed his way to consciousness.
Shaima,
he thought.
Shaima!
There was a shadow above him, framed by the whining ring of his unanswered wards. And there was a great and crushing absence, swinging in small circles from the end of a leather string, a trinket hanging the breadth of a finger above his breast.
Some time ago,
the Skilvendi grated,
during all the empty hours thinking, I understood that you die as I do.
A tremor passed through the hand holding the string.
Without gods.
Even from this distance, Eleazarus could see the faint glow of light spilling from the Tesseract Tabernacle upon the sacred heights. He sat with Iacchus beneath the open canopy that flared from the south face of his pavilion. Circles of blood had been painted across the flattened grasses. Tomorrow, they would at last engage their mortal enemy, and though the meaning of that engagement now escaped him, he would see it through. Which meant he would use every weapon at his disposal, no matter how wicked.
The Kishorum flee,
Iacchus said, his mouth aglow with a diamatic communion.
As we suspected, they have no core upon the Juturum, but they call, they call.
The snakeheads had no choice. They would disperse their trinkets to guard against further incursions by Sifrang, which meant that tomorrow his brother schoolmen would face fewer in their initial assault. Eleazarus leaned forward.
We shouldn't have used a potent when a debile would have suited our purposes just the same, and especially not Zios. You told me yourself he was becoming dangerous.
All is well, Eli.
You grow reckless.
Have I become such a coward?
Iacchus turned to him. Blood soiled his bandages where they pressed against his translucent cheeks.
They must fear us, the man said. Now they do.
The bizarre terror of awakening to a mortal threat, a pang wrapped round with a sluggish incredulity, as though something deep believed he still slept, like a knife probing wool.
Skilvendi!
Akamian gasped. It seemed he mouthed ice more than sound. The stink of the man filled the cramped confines of his tent, a smell somewhere between horse and dog.
Where?
The voice growled from the darkness.
Is he?
Akamian knew he referred to Kellis, either because of the intensity with which he said he, or perhaps because he could scarcely think of anyone else himself. But then, all men searched for Kellis, even those who knew him not. I don't—
Lies! You are always with him. You are his protector. I know this.
Please!
He gasped, tried to cough without raising his chest. The Koray had become unbearable. It seemed his heart might crack his sternum, leap into its absence. He could feel the stinging of his skin about his right nipple, the beginnings of the salt. He thought of Carathusel, of Geshruni, now long dead, holding a trinket above his hand in the holy leper. Strange how this one seemed to have a different taste. I was never meant to escape. The shadow hunched over him in fury, seemed to growl. Though he could see no more than the man's outline limned in the faintest moonlight, Akamian saw him clearly in his soul's eye. The strapped arms, the neck-breaking hands, the face rutted by murderous wrath.
I will not ask again.
What was happening here? Don't panic, old fool.
You think, Akamian managed, I would betray his trust, Skilvendi? You think I value my life over his?
Desperation, not conviction, had animated these words, for he did not believe them. Even still, they seemed to give the Skilvendi pause. A moment of brooding dark, then the barbarian said,
I will trade then. Barter.
Why the sudden reversal? And the man's voice, had it actually quavered? The barbarian yanked the koray into his palm like a child with a well-practiced toy. Akamian fairly cried out in relief. For a moment, he lay panting, still terrified and utterly dumbfounded. The shadow watched, motionless.
Trade! Akamian exclaimed.
For the first time, he noticed the two figures sitting behind the barbarian, though the gloom was such that he could tell only that one was a woman and the other a man.
Trade what?
Truth.
This word, intoned as it was with exhaustion and a profound barbaric candor, struck him like a blow. Akamian pressed himself onto his elbows, glared at the man, his eyes wild with outrage and confusion.
And what if I've had my fill of truth?
The truth of him,
the Skilvendi said. Akamian peered at the man, squinted as if into the distance, even though he loomed so very near. I already know that truth, he said numbly. He's come to—
You know nothing,
the barbarian snarled.
Nothing. Only what he has let you know.
He spat in the corner next to Akamian's uncovered feet, wiped his lips with the hand holding his koray.
The same as all slaves.
I'm no slave.
But you are. In his presence, all men are slaves, sorcerer.
With the koray clutched tight in his fist, the Skilvendi leaned back to sit cross-legged.
He is Dunyane.
Never had Akamian heard such shaking hate in a word. And the world was filled with such epithets. Skilvendi, Consult, Fainim, Kishorim, Mogfarau. It sometimes seemed there were as many hatreds as there were names. That word, Akamian said carefully, Dunyane, it simply means truth in a dead tongue.
The tongue is not dead,
Naor snapped.
And the word no longer means truth.
Akamian recalled that first meeting outside Momum, the Skilvendi standing proud and savage before Proyas, while Kellis had held Serwe amid Zynimus's knights. He hadn't believed Naor then, but the revelation of Kellis and his name Anassarimber had overturned all his suspicions. What was it Kellis had said? That the Skilvendi had accepted his wager? Yes, and that he had dreamed of the Holy War from afar. What you told us, Akamian said, glimpsing the sheen of teeth, that first day with Proyas. You lied.
I lied.
And Kellis? For some reason, asking this made his throat ache. A pause.
Tell me where he went.
No, Akamian said. You promised me truth. I will not barter untested wares. The barbarian snorted. But it didn't strike Akamian as an expression of derision or contempt. There was a pensiveness to the man, a vulnerability of movement and manner that contradicted the violence of his aspect. Somehow Akamian knew that Naor wanted to speak of these things as though they burdened him in the way of crimes or powerful grievances, and this realization terrified him more thoroughly than any trinket ever could.
You think Kellis was sent?
The Skilvendi said in a hollow voice.
When he was summoned, you think he is unique when he is but one of a number. You think he is a savior when he is nothing more than a slaver.
These statements clawed all blood and sensation from Akamian's face. I don't understand.
Then listen! For thousands of years, they have hidden in the mountains, isolated from the world. For thousands of years they have bred, allowing only the quickest of their children to live. They say you know the passing of ages better than any sorcerer, so think on it. Thousands of years until we, the natural sons of true fathers, have become little more than children to them.
What followed was too naked not to be true. The two shadows sitting behind him did not move while he talked, not by the slightest measure. The Skilvendi's voice was harsh, marred by the guttural cadences of his mother tongue, but he spoke with an eloquence that gave the lie to the severity of his race. He told the story of a boy just outgrowing his native fragility, who found himself captured by the words of a mysterious slave and led across trackless expanses between sane acts and upright men. A story of patricide.
I was his accomplice, the Skilvendi said.
Toward the end of his story, he had slouched in thought, speaking more and more to his palms, as though each word were a pebble added to a back-breaking load. Suddenly he raised his fists to his temples.
I was his accomplice, but I was not willing.
He lowered his forearms to his knees, held his fists out as though snapping a bone.
They see our thoughts through our faces, our hurts, our hopes, our rage and our passion. Where we guess, they know, the way herdsmen can read the afternoon's weather in the morning sky. And what men know, men dominate.
Somehow it seemed a shaft of light had found his face, so bright was the anguish in his voice. A Commian could hear his tears, his sneering grimace.
He chose me. He raised me up, and he shaped me, the way women shape flints to scrape their hides. He used me to kill my father. He used me to secure his escape. He used me.
The shadow crossed his fists over his bull chest.
Shame. Utram kut mi puruka murir. I could not stop thinking. I could not stop thinking. I laid eyes upon my degradation. I understood, and I stamped my heart with that understanding.
Without realizing, a Commian wrung finger against finger, joint against joint. There was the Skilvendi shadow and the pit that was his core. Nothing else existed.
He was intellect. He was war. That is what they are. Do you not see? With every heartbeat they war against circumstance. With every breath they conquer. They walk among us as we walk among dogs. And we yowl when they throw out scraps. We whine and whimper when they raise their hands. They make us love. They make us love.
Vast was the night. Great was the ground, and yet they yielded, they yielded. Step, step, leap. Incantations of space, world crossing world. The hares darted from his path, the thrushes burst from his feet, hurtling into the stars. The jackals raced at his side, their tongues lolling, their loping limbs tiring. Who are you? They panted as their hearts failed them.
Your master,
cried the godlike man as he outdistanced them. And though humor was unknown to him, he laughed. He laughed until the sky shook.
Your master.
How could a heart hold such outrage? The sorcerer rocked back and forth in the candlelight, to and fro, muttering, back, back, must start at beginning. But he could not. No, not yet. Never had he been party to such an exchange. Never had such words been thrown upon the balance of his heart. He knew the Skilvendi meant to kill him, his final greatest student. He knew what the two shadows behind the barbarian had been. As they exited his tent, he had seen her face in a shaft of moonlight, as perfect as that night it had swayed and moaned above him.
Serwe. You gave him up. The warrior prophet. You told the barbarian where he goes.
Because he lies. He steals what is ours, what is mine. But the world, fie on the world, let it burn.
The beginning, he cried.
Please.
Before him, spread across his silk bedding, were sheaves of parchment. He dipped his quill in his inkhorn, murmuring. Quickly he wrote all the names of all the factions that had so bedeviled him, redrawing the map that had burned in the Seriotic library. He paused over Inrau, searching for the memory of his sorrow, struck by remembrances that no longer mattered, or so it seemed. And he shuddered so violently at writing the consult. He was forced to set his quill down and hold his arms tight to his chest. You gave him up! No, no! When he was finished, it seemed he held the very same parchment he had lost, and he pondered the identity of things, the way words did not discriminate between repetitions. They were immortal, and yet they cared. With a bold stroke, he crossed out the Emperor and inked Confis underneath, thinking of all the Skilvendi had said regarding the new Emperor, of how even now he marched on the Holy War from the west, or from the sea.
Warn them, the leering shadow had said. I would not see Proyas dead.
He quickly scratched a welter of new lines, all the connections he had ignored since his abduction by the Scarlet Spires. Then, in a hand too steady to be his own, for he was mad, he knew that now, he wrote the Dunyane in the open space to the left of Anassarimber Kellis. He held his quill above the ancient word for some time. Two drops of ink, tap, tap, marred the script. He watched them bleed outward, chasing a million infinitesimal veins, obliterating the word. And for some reason, that spurred him to write Anassarimber Moengis above. The name not of Kellis's son by Serwe, but of his father, the man who had summoned him to the three seas.
Summoned!
He dipped his quill into his inkhorn, his hand as light as an apparition. Then, as though crowded forward by dawning apprehension, he slowly wrote Esmanet against the top left margin. How had her name become his prayer? Where did she fall in these monstrous events? Where was his own name? He stared at the completed map, insensible to the passage of time. The Holy War roused about him. Shouts and the chunk-chunk of hooves passed through his tent, passed through him. He had become a ghost that stared and stared, not really pondering, but watching, as though the secret lay hidden in the ink's immobility. Men, schools, cities, nations, prophets, lovers. There was no pattern to these breathing things. There was no encompassing thought to give them meaning, just men and their warring delusions. The world was a corpse. Zynemus's lesson. Without knowing why, he began connecting each of the names to Shima, where it lay center bottom. Lines, one after another, drawn to the city that was about to devour so many. Guilty and innocent alike, the bloodthirsty city. Her name he connected last of all, for he knew she needed Shima more than any other, save perhaps himself. Once the black thread was drawn tight, he returned the tip of his quill and drew it out once more, and again, and again, and again, quicker and quicker, until he slashed the vellum sheet in a frenzy, cut after cut after cut. For he was sure that his quill had become a knife, and that flesh lay beneath the tattooed skin.